Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This is an RNZ podcast.
Hello?
Piki mai kake mai and a warm welcome to Our Changing World. Ko Alison Balance aho. It's Sea Week, so I figured that we should go to the beach. We're off to Tidy Mouth, south of Dunedin, with biologist John Waters from the University of Otago, genetics PhD student Elihi Parvitsi, and geologist and emeritus professor Dave Craw.
I am walking along the beach with a biologist and a geologist, and we will shortly find out what the two are collaborating on. But John has just picked up a massive piece of bull kelp.
This is Davillia antarctica. It's a widespread around the southern hemisphere species that grows in the intertidal, but it's also buoyant, so it gets broken off from the shore in a storm, and it can actually float for 1,000 kilometres or 10,000 kilometres. It's quite an exciting species.
And it's got this holdfast, which is where it was gripping onto the rock, but it's been torn away, and there's a whole lot of stuff in there.
It's what we call a habitat-forming species, so it almost creates its own ecosystem. And it really becomes the home for a bunch of different species living in the intertidal. Now, in the holdfast I've got here, we can see got a mussel there. We've got a little chiton in here. That's called ornithochiton, and it's what we call a brooding species. It doesn't release its young into the water column, into the sea. The only way that this guy can get around is by crawling a few millimetres. Otherwise, it needs to rely on this kelp to provide a hitchhiking service. So basically, the kelp breaks off and takes the chitons with them, and that's how they can get around. And as a result, both the kelp and the things that are living in there, they're quite interesting to us.
So you've got long-distance travellers and a long-distance travel mechanism, basically.
Well,
it's
right.
Like their bus.
And we've found species that live all the way around the Southern Ocean. So I said the kelp can break off and it can raft, it can float all the way over to Chile. And we've got some of the same species turning up in the same sorts of habitats all the way around the Southern Ocean. So, yeah, we really think this kelp is an important way that these things get around. Another interesting thing I was going to mention here is that you can see in this kelp holdfast there's actually bits of rock that are still attached, which kind of shows how strong the kelp is. It's often the rock that breaks before the kelp breaks in the storm. But because there are different rocks in different places, when one of these breaks off, goes to sea and gets washed back ashore, you can look at the rock and work out where it came from. And Dave here is the geologist, and he can often look at these rocks and say, oh, that's from Fiordland, or that one came down from the Southern Antarctic, or that one's from the Catlins. So he can really help us quantify how far these things travel and how often they travel that sort of distance. So it's a kind of a combination of the biology and the geology makes it quite exciting to work together on this.
So, cue the geologists.
Well, we're standing right on the Akator Fault, which is an active fault just south of Dunedin. It's a well-known active structure that people in Dunedin are well aware of. But we're standing on the fault here, and immediately out to sea, there's a row of rocks, and that's the uplifted side of the fault. So that came up within the last 1,000 years or so and exposed those rocks. And a bit to the north, we've got Tyree Island, which is about the northern limit of the major zone of uplift. The island is there because it's on the uplifted side of the fault. And the fault goes onshore here, heading towards the south. And there's a coastal zone there that has been uplifted over the last 100,000 years or so by something like 60 metres. The biggest earthquake seemed to make an uplift step along the fault of about 2 metres, give or take. So this happens every few hundred years. On the fault itself, it's within the last few hundred years or 1,000 years. And on the coast here, away from the fault, which is where we've been doing our work with the kelp, there are steps that are about 1,000 years old. Right? And the question that we've been trying to answer is, did those steps all happen at once with a big bang, or did they come up incrementally, a little bit at a time? And the question that the biologists want to know is, did it kill all of the intertidal biota when it came up?
Now, if this is sounding familiar, you're right. It's exactly what happened to the Kaikoura coastline during the November 2016 earthquake.
Well, that's right. There are places along that coast that came up 6 to 8 metres, so nothing can have hung on. But that's over a 50 or 60 kilometre zone, where in some places it was really heavily uplifted and other places not so much. So there's that sort of regional effect, as how much got wiped out and how much is going to be able to hold on or come back. And in places where it did get wiped out, what's the time frame of things coming back, and how does that disturbance actually ultimately change things like the genetic distribution and structure of those species? And that's some of the questions that we've got following on from Kaikoura, but also looking back at some of New Zealand's older quakes, like this one down here south of Dunedin, and also the ones that have happened around Wellington in the 1800s. So there are lots of questions out there. But when we look at what's happened here down near the Akator Fault, we can still see a striking genetic signature of that change that happened 1,000 years ago. So Ellie here is doing her PhD. She's just started in the last 6 months. The first thing we thought we'd do is, well, let's have a look. Dave mentioned that we had this active fault just south of Dunedin, so we thought that would be a good place to start. And so we started by genetically comparing the kelp that's growing on that uplifted stretch of the fault on the coast there versus the flanking populations which weren't uplifted to the north and to the south. In our wildest dreams, we thought maybe there'll be something interesting there, but we had no real expectation. But the first thing we found was, bang, hey presto, it's a dramatic difference in the uplifted stretch versus the stretches that weren't uplifted. So it's almost as though you can use the genetics to determine where the uplift happened, and there's a perfect match between the geological uplift and the genetic differences. So it's super exciting for us that you can see the effects of a geological event 1,000 years ago. You can see that today in the things that are still growing there. For us, that's just astonishing that we can see those signatures persisting 1,000 years till today.
So how did kelp disperse? We've looked at a dead adult kelp here that's clearly pulled away from a rock somewhere and floated around, but it's not like a plant. It's not going to take root here again.
We have boy kelps and we have girl kelps. So what we almost need is a boy and a girl kelp to wash up at the same place and then release their sperm and eggs, which can then unite and form a new plant which colonises the intertidal right there. The good thing about this kelp is actually sometimes you get ones that grow conjoined where they share a holdfast. And if we look around here, you can see one over there. So here we've got a holdfast, but there's actually three different plants conjoined there. They've got different stipes. But, you know, one of those might be a boy and one might be a girl. So they're simultaneously able to release their gametes and have a fertilised egg which can then settle on the shore.
So in this study, we've got kelp on one side of the uplifted zone that didn't die. We've got kelp on the other side of the uplifted zone that didn't die. Wouldn't the chances be that it would be the local kelp that would reinvade the empty area?
You'd think it would be something from reasonably nearby that gets in, but really it's a bit of a lottery, and it might just be that the one that got in had come from down in the Catlins or down in Stewart Island or something like that. But equally, it could have come from somewhere further north. And what we think in this case happened was that maybe there was a strong northerly blowing for a few days, and the stuff that's got in has probably come from Otago Peninsula or somewhere like that. You know, so tens of kilometres, even 100 kilometres further north, we think that the kelp that has re-established has come from so far away that it's genetically quite distinguishable from what is immediately north and what's immediately south. So that's why there's such a strong imprint of this, because what got in and replaced the original kelp was so genetically different. There's a question that follows on from that. It's that you get one of these disturbance events and it changes things, but how long can that signature of change last? The idea that you can go and recover a signature from something that's 1,000 years old is pretty cool. Maybe it lasts for 10,000 years. Maybe it lasts for 100,000 years. So that's the sort of question that we really want to look into those things, because that's a kind of a fundamental biological question. If you disturb populations, can you really see the consequences of that extending well into the future? That idea that you can use it to retrace history. So maybe we can go and use these genetic techniques and look at historical or prehistoric earthquakes elsewhere in the world. You know, there are exciting things in the Mediterranean where the coast was uplift in the ancient Roman times or something like that, Pompeii.
I'd love to go to the Mediterranean and do some of these studies. It would be really good. Other people have been doing them in the Mediterranean from the point of view of species. They've been looking at how species get displaced during uplift. But in doing that, it's not easy to tell. The thing that we're trying to tell here, whereas we're trying to distinguish between incremental uplift and sudden big uplift. And just looking at species doesn't do that. If you can find some kind of genetic discontinuity within a species, all of a sudden that really does tell us something that we didn't know before. So we know about the uplift, but we just don't know how it happened.
John mentioned earlier that there are often quite large rocks stuck in the holdfasts of the floating kelp, and there's certainly lots of evidence of this on the beach. In this respect, they're a lot like glacial erratic boulders, which can be enormous chunks of rock, dragged many kilometres from their source by glaciers, which have subsequently melted.
We've had a piece of granite from Snares turned up here, and the big ones, they come from Fiordland, Western Fiordland, so they come right around the coast. We're not sure if they go through Fovo Strait or around the south side of Stewart Island, but they end up here, sometimes, yeah, up to 8-10 kilograms. They're huge rocks, and they would be left on the beach once the kelp rots as an erratic that is very similar to a glacial one. And John and I were working on this when we first started with this kelp rock stuff, pointing out that a lot of the things that have been called glacial erratics offshore New Zealand, thought to have been dropped by icebergs, could actually have been dropped by kelp coming from the south. So that stuff is scattered all over the seafloor out on the Chatham Rise.
Thanks, Dave. That was Dave Craw. And we also heard from biologist John Waters talking about work being carried out by genetics PhD student Elihi Parvitsi, and they are all at the University of Otago. Dave and John, by the way, have both been on Our Changing World before, together and separately, talking about a wide range of things from gold and extinct sea lions to a project using the genetics of freshwater fish to make sense of wide-scale tectonic uplift across the South Island. There are links to all those stories as well as to Sea Week on our webpage, rnz.co.nz/ourchangingworld. Kei te whakaronga mai koe ki tō tātou au horihori. Hei hōtaka e pāna ki tō tātou au whānui. I'm Alison Balance and this is Our Changing World on RNZ. Now it's time to catch up with the Kakapo Files podcast, where we're up to episode 12, following the longest and biggest kakapo breeding season on record. Managing this all is taking a lot of people, and not just the kakapo recovery team from the Department of Conservation, some of whom we've met on the show before. There are also volunteers from around the world, as well as skilled experts from other conservation organisations. Let's meet some of the kakapo helpers.
I am walking around the hut, finding out what people are up to. You're in bright orange overalls with a Meridian logo on. Who are you and what are you here for?
I'm Ruben. I'm from Meridian. I'm just down here just looking after the power system, just checking it out and, yeah, making sure it's working fine.
Now, as the kakapo program has become more and more dependent on technology, I imagine its use of power has grown. So where does the electricity for all of these bits of equipment come from?
So the hut's kind of grown over the years and it's kind of morphed into what it is today. We've come from a variety of powers, because obviously being on an island you can't just plug into the mains. So we have the hydro system, which is not working today because it's quite dry, for quite unusually for down here. And we've also got solar panels, which also feed into it. And we've also got a backup diesel generator if the demand is high.
Hydro, solar and a diesel generator, that's pretty good. So what are you actually doing, just making sure that everything is working properly?
Yeah, giving a bit of a service and making sure it's working properly. And as I say, I've been given a list of little jobs that aren't quite right. So, yeah, just giving it a tidy up, really.
This must be a bit tricky because it's not like you can power down everything and work your way through it.
But yeah, it's just very, very tricky. It's a bit like trying to do a service on a car while it's driving down the motorway at 100 mile an hour.
Well, it's very critical at the moment, and I'm thinking it's particularly critical to have power here because they've got all those eggs in the incubators which they need to keep running. They've got those little chicks that need to stay warm. So you really can't afford the power to go down.
Yes, it's one of them things that you don't realise how important it is until it stops working, really. Pretty quite critical to everything, really, here.
I can hear the generator going. Would we be able to just go and have a quick peek at it to see what it sounds like up close?
Sure.
So the generator is a little distance from the hut, which is a nice thing. It's got its own house. And there she be.
So I guess what my main job is trying to make the solar and the hydro systems more efficient. Because obviously at the moment we are using the generator because the demand is quite high. We have all the incubators and all the people on the island. However, we have made quite a few improvements to the solar system just to so we don't rely on it quite so much.
Well, I might just grab a few seconds of just the generator and then we might leave because it's not the nicest sound in the world. Thanks, Ruben. And while the generator is indeed not the nicest sound for sure, it's a constant background sound around the hut. Now I'm on my way to another engine room of the Kakapo program, the kitchen. But before I get there, I'm going to detour via another iconic whenua ho sound. And that's the toilet sign being put across the track on the way to the composting toilet to indicate that it's occupied. Right, back to the hut. It sounds a bit like a factory, but that's actually the whistle of a kettle on the stove. But it doesn't mean I'm going to get a cup of tea. There are two kettles here, one for humans and one for kakapo chicks, which that one is, not that they drink tea. It's specially designated for heating and sterilising the water that will be used to bring chick food up to the perfect temperature. The chicks are fed every 2 hours to begin with, so that sound is a very familiar one. And there is a very familiar face hard at work in the kitchen. So, Shrike, I'm ambushing you in the kitchen. Can I get you to quickly introduce yourself and say who you are and what you're doing on whenua ho?
Shrike O'Malley. I'm the cook here for the next couple of weeks.
So that seems like quite a big job. There's about 16 people on the island.
Yeah, it's an exciting job. I like the outside stuff too, so it's a nice combination. So I get to go out during the morning, some mornings, and do things kakapo, and then come back here and cook up.
Keep people going.
Keep people going, that's right. And juggle the different dietary requirements and, try and keep everyone happy, but, Not a trained cook, so the person before me was a trained chef and he was extraordinary, so hard act to follow, but I think I'm doing okay.
So what have you got on the menu for tonight?
Tonight it's vegetable and, for non-vegetarians, mince, kind of like a Cornish pasty pie sort of thing, and I'm doing kumara strips that are just dry roasted, and then because we've got lots of broccoli that needs eating, we're having steamed broccoli as well.
Now, that raises the interesting point that it's a bit feast or famine out here. You don't have the shop to pop down to. You can't go to the supermarket.
No, that's
so logistically,
right.
How does the food out here work?
Oh, I think they've done an extraordinary job of keeping this place stocked. So despite it being a really busy season, there still seems to be lots of fresh vegetables and fruit, which is fantastic. Copious supplies of chocolate to keep all the rangers and hard workers happy, and plenty of other food. Really, we've run out of odds and ends, but really, really, it's no dramas. There's plenty to cook with and there's plenty of good variety of energy-rich and nutritious food, so it's pretty impressive.
So it's a bit like you're the engine room for the Kakapo Recovery Programme.
Don't know about that.
You're keeping everybody fueled.
Well, yeah, to some extent. I think the chocolate biscuit cupboard keeps everyone fueled and the chips and everything else, but, yeah, it's great being part of it.
Oh, well, you're beaming from ear to ear, so you must be having a good time, and I should let you get back to making kumara strips.
Lovely, thank you.
Thanks, Shrike.
And the Hut Kitchen isn't the only place on Whenua Hau where volunteers are preparing meals.
Hi, I'm Ian Dorrington. I'm from Bristol and over here just to help out with the feeding programme.
Hi, I'm Mark Flowers. I'm from Bristol and I'm helping out on the feeding programme too.
So you're in charge of the nuts room. So what are you up to at the moment? It's about 8 o'clock in the morning and you look like you're getting busy for something.
So we're just setting ourselves up for the day. We're kind of weighing out all the food for the birds that we're going to do on our run today. We're doing two runs. We're doing the DB run and the South Bay run, and we've got 14 birds to feed. Sue, Bella, Wolf, Queenie, Jean, I think that's Nog, Awarua, Moss, some of the handwriting's good, Gumboots, Hakateri, Huhana, Margaret, Marie, Ruth and Bonus.
And we're just about to get Gumboots his 180 grams of fine pirate food.
Ah, so they've got a meal plan for every individual kakapo.
Yeah, we have to be really careful. There's a big board in the room where we're at, a big whiteboard, and you can see each of the birds has their own, what we're feeding them. Then we have to carefully record what we take away from them so we can monitor how much they're eating every day and how much to give them the next day.
And how do you deliver this parrot food? I assume you're not going and hand-feeding them?
No, there are hoppers distributed all over the island, and there's a variety of hoppers. There's some hoppers which are electronically operated by the birds. Some have a data collection system, so they can actually monitor which birds are feeding.
Well, I better let you get on, so these hungry birds will have their full plates waiting for them by the end of the day.
There we are. We can't keep the kakapo for their breakfast.
And we're not normally up at this time. We're just trying to get ahead of the rain today.
Yeah.
Thanks, Ian. Thanks, Mark. Now, the nut room isn't very big, but as well as being the kakapo kitchen, it's also serving as the sperm laboratory, where sperm collected from male kakapo up the hill is brought back to be studied.
I'm Helena. I'm a vet and a scientist from Germany, and I've come to help with the AIs this season. But what I do mostly is sit here at the lab and do sperm investigations.
Well, my name is Andy, I'm a vet too, and we are working in the same working group, avian reproduction. Most of my research I did in assisted reproduction in parrots, and that's how we came here. I stay 4 weeks on this island, and we try to help in the assisted reproduction, especially in the artificial insemination to improve the number of fertile eggs.
So you've been out today collecting some semen, some sperm. Now what are you up to?
Andy has just done the sperm concentration calculation, so that is how many sperm are there per microliter and how many spermatozoa are there in the whole semen sample. Then we have investigated the pH value and the viability, and what I'm now going to do is to dilute the residual semen with different diluents and investigate it over a period of time to have a look at the sperm viability and motility. So I'm going to investigate the sample for at least three days, if not even 4 or 5 days. Because you're not always able to inseminate on the same day as the semen collection. But if you have to do it some other day, you would like the semen sample to be as viable and as motile as possible. So that's only possible if the semen sample is provided with energy and nutrients to keep the spermatozoa alive.
Now, the word sperm count was mentioned, so what have you found in your counting?
The concentration today from Wolf is 3 million sperm per microliter.
Sounds an awful lot.
That sounds a lot. It's quite much more than some other parrots. Macaws, for example, they have about 30,000 only per microliter, so the difference is quite strong. But the other kakapos we tried, they had a much higher concentration, up to 8 or even 10 million per microliter. So the sample, the motility was not so good and the concentration was not so good neither.
What is also very important to investigate is the sperm morphology, because even if spermatozoa are alive and motile, if the sperm morphology isn't good enough, so for example, if the spermatozoa have triple heads or double tails...
I didn't even know that was a thing.
Yeah, it is. For example, one sample of gumboots was awful. He had lots of triple tails and retroversion of the tails and many deformed head of the spermatozoa. But Gulliver had very good semen samples, so he had the most normal spermatozoa of all.
Thanks, Helena, and thanks, Andy. And that's excellent news about Gulliver's normal sperm, as he's one of the kakapo with Fiordland genes and genetically quite different from the rest of the population. The kakapo breeding season continues apace, by the way. Last I heard, the egg tally had reached 218 and there were 50 chicks alive out of 52 hatched. Of course, those numbers are almost certainly higher by now as they increase by the day. And that's it for this week. If you'd like to listen to tonight's stories again and catch up with the latest episode of the Kakapo Files, head to our webpage, rnz.co.nz/ourchangingworld. The Elemental podcast, celebrating 150 years of the periodic table, has two new episodes this week, Antimony and Argon. Stay in touch. We're on Twitter and Facebook at RNZ Science. Thanks for your company. I'll be back next week, but for now it's good night from me, Alison Balance. Paul Marie.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.